Hi, Francis.
Hey, Mark. Francis, how are you? Fabulous. Excellent line all the way through to Johannesburg. I have Mark Bruno. I'm delighted to have Mark as our guest on the podcast today, and I'm going to give everyone a wee heads up as to why they should listen. And I'm very fortunate to have spent some time. We did our MBAs respectively at a simultaneous period. But Mark is an American citizen that was a former director of the World Trade Center. Yes, you heard that right. That was Johannesburg, however, rather than New York. During the constitutional negotiations in SA, South Africa, that was a big period for us, as many will know. He's also grown up in a Sicilian family. I remember when working with Mark, if you ever said Italian, you got a short clip round the head. There's a big difference to him, and I'm sure I've raised a wry smile on his side. Strong connections to the Sicilian underworld. He knows how it operates. I'm not going to go too much further on that. He was a nephew of one of the founding members of the CIA. So Mark's had a very unusual, safe to say, upbringing and very interesting access to all sorts of various power players that were in his immediate family. He's a holder of an MBA through with specific reference to international trade and finance, very similar to mine, actually, and has performed various development and finance services to top-level government players throughout Africa. So, Mark, thank you for making the time. Just a great CV, generally, for the Reset podcast. There's stuff I can't put in there that I know you might embellish where you see fit. But welcome to the Reset podcast.
Yeah, thanks very much, Francis. Great to be speaking to you.
We've got a couple of topics that Mark is particularly strong on, especially given some of that which I mentioned in the intro. But one of the things that just came across my desk today and that we just discussed and was also following on from a recent discussion when I was out in South Africa with Mark was the oil price and all that's been going on technically. For those that follow us will know that we actually called a short at $103 on that one. We're one of the first for technical reasons, not understanding the fundamental wisdom. Mark is someone who actually has a better idea on all of that. We're getting a bit of a rally now, Mark. What's your take?
Yeah, you know, Francis, I always tend to take a political view on these things because, you know, the markets, even though they're supposed to be independent, they're supposed to be driving themselves, governments tend to use them to achieve political ends. You know that this bill was just passed in the United States, this 911 Saudi Arabia bill.
Wow.
Nice. The Senate passed it. It's got to go to the House, and then the president has to sign it. But this obviously caused a huge rankle in Saudi Arabia, and you know could have some very, very significant repercussions globally. You know, it kind of leads into this whole thing about, you know, it's very interesting. You know, obviously, as you said in the intro, you know, I grew up in an environment where, you know, on one side of my family were underworld figures, and on the other side of my family were government underworld figures. And I got raised by, I had a lot of contact with these guys, and they taught me to look at things very differently to the way that most people look at things, you know. In fact, I was always told that if you think it's this, then it definitely isn't, you know. It's always a misdirect. It's always a redirect. So I think we're in the midst of a fairly tumultuous political period, and we're going to start seeing these political plays played out in the commodity markets, particularly oil, because the dollar is essentially based on oil these days.
Yeah, I'd go with that. In fact, there's one or two commentators that have said that there might be a big unravel on the Saudi-US relationship and a pivoting away from Saudi. We had the 28 pages that, you know, are redacted on 9/11. It seems like, and Trump even in campaigning on Bush, they sort of rewarmed some of what went on with 9/11 and the Saudi connection. It seems like there's a little bit of cantankerousness in that. Is this all just fluff for the headlines? Is this part of the misdirect, or is there a real feeling in that?
No, I think that, you know, it kind of depends on how deeply you want to go into the theory of things, you know, and how much you want to try to understand the men that are involved. I mean, you know, I'm trying to stay away from the conspiracy theory aspects of things, but I have grown up in that environment, and I've learned that where there's smoke, there's fire. You know, there's always been this concern as to whether or not Obama is a Muslim or not, and if he is a Muslim, which one? You know, is he Sunni or is he Shiite? Well, he was raised by Shiites, and the Shiites are aligned to Iran, and we've made alignment with Iran. You know, we've signed this nuclear deal with them. And the Sunnis are driven, they're predominant, and they are in Saudi Arabia and all these other places. And it certainly looks as though he's trying to cause them difficulty, although not overtly. You know, he sort of smiles and stabs them in the back. So, you know, there's a lot going on. I mean, there's a huge amount of geopolitical activity that's taking place, that's playing itself out. And, you know, if you think about it, oil is on a downward trend. I mean, oil is a 125-year-old technology that is played out its day. I mean, we don't, you know, oil is going to die soon. There's a lot of new battery technology coming in. There's all kinds of advances at an atomic level, let alone nuclear level, that are going to change the dynamic of energy in the world. So if you're...
Those have existed resources for a while, Mark. My dad went over to Germany in the 70s for battery cars, and it was California and the U.S. that kept killing it, which I called the Rockefeller tax. They didn't like the idea. In fact, more recently, the A-Class Mercedes was designed for a battery, and that's why it kept falling over, because they had to convert it to a combustion engine. I don't know if you know the one, the little one, has a slab of a side. So are we going to ever, are we getting to the point where we properly will escape, you know, the fossil fuels thing, you think?
I think, you know, we had peak oil a few years ago, and I think that the generalized cost on several levels, I mean, I won't even get into the global warming and all that stuff, because that's just too big of a debate, but generally the cost of oil is getting too high. And there are new technologies coming out. I mean, for years and years and years, battery technology really never advanced. Now they have these aluminum batteries. They're testing them. You know, you can take a block of aluminum and it'll run an entire household for 3 or 4 months. And then, you know, you just replace it with another block of aluminum.
I'm a massive fan of solar and batteries and all of that. But is it true that it's got so high if you consider the dollar devaluation? I mean, I think Ron Paul said we've lost 97% of our original value of the dollar. Is it not just where it should be for
a lot of the
financial machinations?
A lot of the costs aren't measurable at this point. So, you know, in terms of a replacement, you know, let's start with the premise that it's a very, very old technology. And as a very, very old technology, it's sort of run its day. You know, there's been no significant advances in formulations or anything in 100 years. So, I mean, it's pretty obvious that there's moves to try to replace this technology in the world, right?
Yeah. I mean, automobiles seems to be the Apple of the motor industry, doesn't it, now, where Apple has lost its innovative shine. Old Elon Musk, a chap from Pretoria, is now almost the lead innovator now, isn't he?
Yeah, I have 100%. And I mean, you know, there's all these social, political, futurist guys that do these postulations, and they think through all these things, and they come up with some really clever assumptions. One of them being that the Internet of Things, I'm sure you're familiar with that,
yes.
The Internet of Things is becoming so prominent and sort of taking hold in society that, you know, in the foreseeable future, in the very foreseeable future, you know, the use of a car will be unlikely. You know, we'll have this giant sort of Uber that's running these Google-style no-driver cars around, and, you know, at a very, very low cost. And the demand for petrol will cease to be. You know, there just won't be a need for it. So, you know, society's having to adapt. You know, I mean, the economy is changing. I mean, it's evolving. It's becoming something entirely different. And oil was the basis of the 20th century in many, many ways. So as the 20th century
came, and the Saudi-U.S. alliance, the petrodollar, was a cornerstone to them having a working relationship. And if that's starting to split away, are we talking, coming back, I suppose, to the original Sunni versus Shiite aspect, are we likely to see an unraveling of that relationship? Because let's be frank, I mean, we talk about barbaric Middle Eastern nations and go do regime change, but there's none so barbaric as Saudi itself. But the media coverage of the beheadings and the buried up to your head stonings for women who've looked the wrong way or got teen pregnancy type offenses, if we put that in inverted commas, doesn't get much coverage. But is that possibly going to change?
I think we're seeing it as we stand here. We are watching the disintegration of the geopolitical alliances that have existed for many, many years. I mean, Donald Trump, whether he becomes president or not, he's talking about dissolving NATO. And what's really interesting is that a lot of people commented on that and said, yeah, he's absolutely right. We don't need NATO. NATO is geared toward protecting us from a certain enemy that, in essence, doesn't really exist anymore. So when you start talking about things like NATO dissolving, the political alliance between the United States and Saudi Arabia, I mean, it's a new world. It's realigning itself. It's completely realigning itself, which is, you know, part of the reason we're seeing so many of these whipsaws in all these different markets. You know, these markets are not changing. They're dying. And, you know, in my opinion, I mean, something we get into a little bit later, but in my opinion, the entire mechanism, the entire need and capital structure of the world is dying. And there's, you know, valid reasons for that. It's, you know, it's based on evolution in essence. But as that takes place, you see all these things happening and you see a lot of people running around trying to, you know, squeeze the last few cents out of the nickel. You know, guys are pumping oil like crazy for a reason because they know it's not going to be worth anything in a few years. Yeah. So if your entire wealth is based on something that's in the ground and the price is falling, I mean, the price is falling, you pump it as fast as you can, period.
Yeah. And you might have which only accelerates the whole process, but you're in a race against all the others who are going to do the same as well.
100%. I mean, Venezuela is dying, and they have the largest reserves in the world, and they're dying. Now, they'll have a... You know, those people will be applauding more than most to see oil at $50 or above $50. But is it going to stay there? I mean, I can't really tell you what's caused it to happen. You know, I haven't really done a complete analysis of the market. I just became aware of it, you know, not very long ago and today. But these things happen. You know, markets tend to do this. Players in the market tend to play this game. Prices go up and then they go down. Prices go up and then they go down. You know, people come in and they get wiped out. You know, the smart money tends to play this game. You know, they tend to run prices up and then bring in fact, you know, I mean,
We never move in straight lines, we always say.
No.
In a downtrend, the harshest upside move is always in a downtrend. You get the strongest buying bid actually in a downtrend because you get these reactional spikes.
Exactly.
So it's a trader's nightmare for most.
I mean, listen, in I did a transaction on Wall Street once, and I was actually in a guy's office, and I watched him manipulate the market. And they have a term for people. They call them bag holders. You know, they just manipulate markets and run prices and do this and do that. And, you know, that's the way markets work. That's the reality of the world. You know, that's how things go.
Talking as us all as the bag holders, and just going back to the Obama element, we talk about presidents being the temporary management and the real management being that which stands behind them that is pretty permanent but far more covert of nature. Is it? Do you think Hillary was very, very almost a shoe-in and Obama just got edged ahead? You know, do you think the Muslim connection, if he was brought up in that kind of a home household, he was brought forward to bring forward this geopolitical shift, maybe? In other words, it's kind of convenient. We can't attribute too much of what I'm saying is we can't attribute too much of this just to be Obama because it's the geopolitical game that is macro and strategic. We've got Elon Musk getting a lot of marketing, you know, about the new world without combustion engines. We're getting it's all too synchronistic, isn't it? Choreographed,
orchestrated.
Yeah.
I mean, look, there's an old saying in the United States that said presidents are selected, they're not elected. And you know, when you speak about Obama or Clinton or Bush or any of them, you know what you're really talking about is you're talking about a front man, right? I mean, you're talking about, my father had a fairly close relationship to Ronald Reagan, and you know, it was quite comical, actually, to see how Ronald Reagan became president. I mean, you know, they approached Ronald Reagan when they wanted him to run for governor of California, and his only concern was he didn't like to fly. He was afraid of flying. So his only concern was, do I have to fly?
Yeah.
And when they assured him that, you know, they could use buses and trains, he said, okay, I'll run. You know, I mean, that's a selection process. That's not an election process. That's somebody who gets put in place, right?
Yeah, for many that may be a bit younger than us, Mark, of course, he was in the entertainment Hollywood industry and was a film star, as was his 100%. Wife.
Yeah, she was, I mean, great communicator. right? Yeah. I mean, a fantastic communicator, which is what the country needed at the time. We needed somebody who could communicate. He raised expectations. He got people believing again. He accomplished the military-industrial complex's agenda, spent trillions of dollars, and, you know, everybody was quite happy. You know,
everybody outspent the Soviets, essentially, on the principle that if he went from 3% to 6% of GDP, they'd have to go from 30% to 60% on military spend, which would
100%. He bankrupted them.
Yeah.
It was a great strategy. It worked, right? And the country was happy, and, you know, the military was big, and everything was great.
Yeah, I'm all for those kind of wars rather than the shooting kind, but I don't know if we are going to be able to avoid the major conflict variety. How do you see? I mean, the whole idea of the podcast is we know there's a reset coming, or we think we know, as you quite correctly say. We never really know anything, but we have this deep-seated suspicion. What's the real reason why the elite want to see a currency reset, if they do, assuming we are accurate?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, it's a really interesting question. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of definitions in there that we could probably debate, and we won't debate them. I mean, like, what is the elite? You know, what do we mean by reset? There's a lot of questions there. But at a fundamental level, what my belief is that, we are in the process of experiencing a paradigmatic shift in the way the economy functions. Now, I'm not going to spend too much time, but let me just give you a sort of where we were and where we're going thing. I mean, for many, many years, we have 6,000 years of recorded history or thereabouts, and over a lot of that period of time, we were essentially a feudal society, right? Not America or South Africa or Britain, but, you know, generally around the world, right? We were this feudal society. And if you really think about it, there wasn't a whole lot of demand for capital. I mean, for the most part, money was used for taxes. I mean, it was kind of, that's just about it. You know, people traded bread for eggs and whatever. They had this whole thing. And the economy, the product was actually sort of grown, you know, right? The product that derived out of the economy was something that grew. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of, you know, there's an old saying, there's a scripture that says that, you know, I plant, you water, and God brings the harvest, right? So, this whole concept was an economy that was sort of organic, if I can use that terminology.
Yeah, yeah, organic growth, pretty
right?
much.
So then we start. So then we start going through these various revolutions. You know, these various industrial revolutions. Some people say four. Some people say three. But, you know, we went from, you know, the Romans used water power, and then steam became important, and the combustion engine went oil. And now we're in this new revolution, which is basically a technological revolution. Now, the impact of that is really, really, really significant. Really significant. I want to use something that, you know, something that happened in my life, how I became aware of this sort of, and what made me sort of study this, was that one day, I buy a lot of books, as you know. I buy a lot of books. And I used to go to the store, and I used to buy a book, and I'd buy the paper book, and I'd take it home, and I'd read it, right? And then that got kind of, you know, not only expensive, but you couldn't always get the latest things. I mean, you know, you'd read about something online, you're doing research online, and you come across a book, you want to study it, and you can't get it because it hasn't come out yet, but it's available on Amazon or one of these other digital things. So I started buying digital books. I got myself a Kindle, and I started buying digital books. And I discovered that the price dropped a lot when I started buying digital books. So it was a great thing. Then I discovered that if I really took my time and I looked a little bit further, most of the time I could find the book for free online. Somebody had taken it, copied it, put it online. You know, most of the time I could do that, right? So I started to change my mindset, and I started to be conditioned into this idea, this thought pattern that, you know, why should I pay? You know, why am I going and spending X amount of $10 or $12 or $15 for a book when I should be getting it for free? And immediately I was sitting one day and I was looking at, you know, books and online, and I thought, you know, why don't they just have a library somewhere where I pay them $5 a year? And I can read as many books as I can read. I mean, certainly the technology exists for me to download it, read it, and put it back, right? I mean, that has to exist, right? I mean, it's got to be out there. And I realized at that moment in time that we were driving towards the marginal cost line. You know, as an economist, you understand that, you know, in a competitive world, the law, the economic law, says that you must drive towards the marginal cost line, right? In my mind, I had a different term for it. I was calling it the zero factor cost economy. And I wrote a couple papers, you know, just to kind of like get an idea of this, you know, zero cost economy. But it forced me to go out and start looking and start doing research. And lo and behold, I came across, you know, quite a few people, quite a few economists and theorists who are saying, look, with the transfer of technology, with the change in technology, when you have 3D printing and you have, you know, a vast amount of the production of the world is digital, the marginal cost is falling very quickly to zero.
It is. I mean, I've got to stop you and come in here. This is incredibly synchronistic. I was having a similar discussion with a gentleman at a cafe, Open Plan, outside one of our nice sunny days. And someone else at another table was overhearing us, little did I know, and we were chatting. And he said, I really loved listening in on your conversation there. This is a book you really need to get. And I've got the piece of paper, makes rustling noise to show that it's still here on his desk. The Zero Marginal Cost Society, Jeremy Rifkin.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I think you had a very interesting book that I'm going to ask you to tell me again because I intend to get it and have a read because we were talking about this when we had a preamble earlier on in the week. What was the title of that one?
You're talking about J. Kenneth Galbraith, The New Industrial State.
The New Industrial State, where we're going to go all towards, because I think apart from the reset, I'm really interested in how will society look on that one. And I think those two books together will tell you very much about where you go. Sorry to interject on that. Carry on with your flow, but I'm interested.
No, it's great. It's great. I mean, you're 100% right. I mean, and where I'm going to end in this little rattle I'm going on is I'm going to you know, tell you where I think we're going. Is that what there's several impacts of this. I mean, when I was young, I had a machine shop in the United States. Okay. Now, when I needed to go buy a tool, I had to go out, get it designed. I had to bring it to a guy who specialized in that particular type of materials or whatever. And it might cost me $100,000 for that tool. I would have to amortize that cost over a certain amount of production run or whatever. But it might cost, and that's not an exaggeration. I mean, I paid $100,000 for some tools, right? Now, in today's world, I download the design from the internet. I take it to my 3D printer and I 3D print it and I've got a tool and it works. Now, it may not last as long as the other tool, but it doesn't matter because what did it cost me? What, you know, $5, right? So that isn't zero, but it's pretty close to zero.
Yeah.
Right? So I started to think about as we move towards this zero cost economy. I mean, I read this article today, Francis, I'm really sorry. I can't remember the name of the company, but I read this article today that this particular company was laying off 65,000 workers to replace them with robots. And I thought, that is the zero-cost economy taking over. I mean, a robot doesn't take breaks. It doesn't eat. It doesn't stop. The labor input of a robot is nearly zero.
We've got a centi-millionaire over here called Jim Mellon. And he wrote a very interesting book. I spoke at the Master Investor there, and he's particularly fascinated by this, and he's talking about the wholesale retooling of productivity. In fact, all manual jobs almost being entirely removed. And
I mean,
robotization of.
You know, Germany published a report about 6 months ago. Angela Merkel asked for a report on the German economy, and she asked a specific question. How much of the German economy today could be replaced by mechanization or robotization or, you know, automation? The report came back and said 65%.
And it would be better quality. That's what they found in the production lines on vehicles.
Certainly more consistent, right?
Yeah, consistent.
So what we have is we have this situation where everything is driving towards the marginal cost economy. Entire segments of the economy are disappearing in front of our face. I mean, in the United States, I was there last year. I couldn't find a bookstore because why would I have a bookstore? I mean, I just go online and buy books, right? It's just too expensive at the bookstore. So you're getting entire segments of the economy getting erased. Well, my background is finance, as you know, as yours is, and I started to think, okay, well, how does this affect money? What's the impact of this? And I came to a couple really interesting conclusions. And, you know, there are probably economists out there that would challenge me, but I'm going to give some interesting facts to support my position. You know, in the Industrial Revolutionary period, remember I started by saying, back in the day, thousands of years ago, capital wasn't really that important, right? I mean, you didn't need a lot of capital. You planted seed, you watered it, and it grew. There was nothing you could do to make it happen. The sun made it happen, right? And then you would have to go and reap that crop, and you would maybe convert it into some, you know, some of it went to bread, and some of it went to wine, and some of it went to make clothes, whatever. But those activities were pretty low in terms of, I mean, the marginal cost of that activity was fairly low to begin with, right?
Yeah.
As we moved into this industrial age, capital became really, really, really important. I mean, we had to build machines. We had to build distribution systems. We had to build large capital flows began to take place. We had huge amounts of capital flowing. I mean, the GDP of the world is about $100 trillion today, right? So we built this capital infrastructure, this intermediary system that is supposed to move capital from surplus to need. We have this huge system, massive system. And what do we start seeing happening? Well, we start seeing a diminishing in the demand for real capital. Now, I'm not talking about a demand for somebody who wants to...
Or is it that we've had an oversupply? If we look at the central bank's behavior and the expansion of liquidity, is it such that it's no longer treated preciously and there's been too much malinvestment due to a liquidity boom?
I think that's a symptom rather than a cause.
Right.
And I'll tell you why. I mean, let me finish this thought and then I'll come back to that specific question. So as we have this massive creation of capital, in those days, if you wanted to build a business, you needed real capital. You had to go out and you had to get money and get equipment and inventory and blah, 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 blah. So we built this huge mechanism to deliver this capital, right? And the GDP grew and all this sort of thing happened. Then we started having this changeover. And sometime in the 1960s, you know, 50s and 60s, it started. By the 80s, it was full bloom, where we had this technology boom, right? I mean, I was in the microcomputer industry in the 1980s, and it was still fairly capital intensive. I mean, it was all about hardware, right? Mm. You had to have
big machines. Chips and machines and everything.
Yeah, I mean, you had to have big machines that made these chips, and they sliced them, and they cut them, and they did. And it was expensive. It cost a lot of money. Development costs were really, really high.
Silicon Valley kind of still carries the name of that era, while now it's actually, it should be Internet Valley now, shouldn't it?
Yeah,
Web Valley.
You know, the Internet world or something,
cloud
right?
Cloud Valley.
Yeah, Cloud Valley, exactly, cloud. So as this took place, and we had this taking place, eventually that technology began to mature, right? And we are now in this phase of that technology development. You know, there was some think tank in the United States. I don't remember who it was. It was, you know, one of these skunk work guys that did an analysis of the 21st century. And they said they estimate that the technological advancement in the 21st century will be 1,000 times what it was in the 20th century. Now, if you consider we went from horse and buggy in the transportation industry, we went from horse and buggy to space shuttle in the 20th century. And we're going to do 1,000 times that in the 21st century.
But isn't the lowest common denominator people's ability to adjust to such change always going to be the anchor and drag on
this?
We're going to
get there because the issue is that this wave is going to crest without us. You see, we are now at the point of they are actually producing and selling quantum computers in the United States. Artificial intelligence has been broken. I mean, the Jade Helm exercise that they held in the United States was an artificial intelligence activity. It was a test of artificial intelligence. They handed over massive amounts of troops in a simulated war scenario and said, you decide. They give it to a computer. You decide. You command the troops. You go out and you figure out who the targets are. You monitor the flow of information.
And how did that go? Because I remember there was a lot of concern and there was a lot of conspiracy chatter about Jade Helm.
Yeah, people were freaked out about it because you know, because first of all, nobody knew what it meant. But Jade was actually a computer system. It was an artificial intelligence system, and the idea is Jade at the helm. So the military was trying to figure out how to hand all this stuff over. I mean, just a slight diversion. I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing. You know, I used to have a company in the United States that bought technology. That's what we did. It was called Technology Exchange. And we used to go out and we used to buy technology from universities, people, whatever, and then I'd sell it, right? I got into problems because I sold stuff to the wrong people, and the FBI said, you have a choice. You can quit or